Good afternoon, everybody. If you could find a seat, we're going to get started here.
Good afternoon. I'm Darren Gill. I'm the Deputy Director of Technical Utility Services. We kick off our second Act 129 on-bill financing working group meeting. In the first meeting, we basically just kind of not really set ground rules, but had a little feeling out as to where we want to go with this. And we're going to continue that today, maybe get into a little more concrete material. Before I turn it over to Laura and to Sarah, who are really the technical leads that are going to be running this, I just want to make sure that everybody that's here knows that your input will go into the staff document. What I mean by that is the order that came out charged Technical Utility Services and Bureau of Consumer Services with putting together this working group and coming up with an ultimate product. We're going to try to, in the ultimate product, take the working group consensus positions and put them in the recommendations. To the extent that your viewpoint may not be part of the consensus, it will also be part of the working group document so that you don't feel like you're getting shut out or that you have lost a voice in here. We want everybody to participate right to the end, even if the consensus doesn't seem to be going your way. That also said, if the working group decides, 50 people to zero to do something, and the staff doesn't necessarily concur with that recommendation, you might see something in the final product that says the working group recommended X, however, staff has a differing opinion. So, because it ultimately is the work product that we're recommending to the commission as staff. But we want to make sure that you know that your input, whether it's a consensus or otherwise, will be in the report. So those of you who might be in the minority on this, make sure that when it comes to report review time, that you take a look at that and make sure that your section is properly represented. And I'll take any questions on that really quickly before we start is there anybody has any questions with the process or how your particular viewpoint will be represented? Yes.
This is Donna Clark from the Energy Association. Just the process. Do you have a timetable? Will there be a report put together, an opportunity for comment? How are you going to get to the report? And do you have some dates in mind yet?
Yes and no to all that. We're anticipating sending out a draft report to the working group, having people put in comments, make sure that what we believe is what the working group believes. I don't know that. I think probably in this meeting today or the next meeting is when we'll start putting together timelines and dates. Right now we're more at conceptual stage. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to Laura and to Sarah and let them essentially run the meeting. And so it's all yours.
Thank you for for those of you who are here at the last meeting, thank you very much for everything that you submitted to us. It was really helpful to have all of your material, and we appreciate it. I sent out an email yesterday and another today for some information that I missed. It's a fairly large one. So I hope that you all received all of the reference material that we've been looking at. Is there anybody who didn't, just by the show of hands? So I just want to make sure that I'm getting everything out to everybody. Okay, it looks good.
Is there anybody that did not provide their name to these folks for the email list? I guess is the question. We will make sure we have everybody on that list. If you haven't been receiving the emails, please let us know.
Yep, and to that end also, please make sure that if you haven't signed in, that you sign in. Especially if I don't have your name already on the list. And just a bit of housekeeping, we are recording this meeting so that we have a recorded record of it, an audio record. So anytime you speak, if you could speak into the microphones, that would be most helpful, including anybody in the audience out there. Just we can turn on the standing mic.
As Laura said, we did receive a lot of reference material. Some of it was duplicates, and everybody's seen some of the same reports. But to that end, we've compiled it all. She sent it out, and we know that there's new information coming out on a regular basis. Sometimes we're familiar with the sources and sometimes we're not. So as we move forward in this process, continue to send us that information and we will make it available to the group. That would be really helpful. Do you want to go into introductions?
I guess we could do that.
Just real quick, get out of the way.
Really, we've got quite a fairly large group. So if we could just go and do a very quick introduction, just your name and the company that you're with, that would be helpful. And don't worry about talking into the microphone for this one. We'll record it as best we can.
Frank, you want to?
Frank Jeruska, PECO.
Kent Hatt with First Energy.
Donna Clark with the Energy Association.
Karen Markey with the Energy Association.
Doug Kroll, PPL Electric Utilities.
Dirk Childs, PPL Electric Utilities.
Chris Brown, Law Bureau.
Sarah Dewey, Bureau of Consumer Services.
Laura Ettinger, Technical Utility Services.
John Costello, Sustainable Energy Fund.
Dave Evans, Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency.
Tanya McCloskey, Office of Consumer Advocate.
Aaron Beatty, Office of Consumer Advocate.
Dan Asmus, Office of Small Business Advocate.
Alyssa Berger, Penn Future.
Courtney Lane, Penn Future.
Great, thank you all. Let's go ahead and get to it.
Okay, with the agenda, we sent out a proposed pilot program that several of the groups here worked together to put together for us for today. And John Costlow has kindly volunteered to present this to us today, so I will turn it over to him.
Thank you, Laura. If we want to go to the next slide. Okay, we worked on putting a pilot program together for Pennsylvania that focused on the small business group. We focused on the small business group because those seem to be the hardest group for any utility to reach as far as their EE&C programs went. We tried to design a program that covered 100% of the upfront costs, that recaptured the costs of the program from the participants, lowered the overall utility bill, was in alignment with the current EGS EDI requirements for implementation, and then also covered either the EDC or LDC costs associated with the program. So those were some of the items we were looking at when we put this together. And it took us that time period in between probably five or six different calls and groups of paper going back and forth. You can't see this from out there. Put it up here. But
can't see it out here either.
Does anyone
not in this light
the document that shows the screen print? I'll walk everyone through it.
Can they turn up the lights?
I wish we could.
Okay.
There's five components to the plan. There's the energy user, the contractor, an on-bill administrator, the electric distribution company or local gas company, and then a capital pool of capital pool providers. The first step is the application or the request for funding, and the on-bill administrator would receive that funding. The next step is between the on-bill administrator is actually the review of both the technical aspects of the project as well as the credit of the project. And for smaller projects, what we focused on was making the credit requirement very similar to what the utility industry has done in the past, where you look at a customer's performance on paying their utility bill over a 24-month period of time. So in large part, it's based on that. There's a credit request that goes from the on-bill administrator to the EDC asking what the customer's payment history has been. And then there's a decision made on whether it's a viable loan or not. After the credit review, there is either a program denial letter or approval. And then you get into the next slide, which is the execution of documents and, yes, the execution document, then the next slide, which is the disbursement requests. We tried to put some checks and balances in here. So what we did is we designed the program where the customer would request the disbursement to the contractor. So the contractor would be paid, but the request would have to come from the customer. So it puts a step in there to ensure that the contractor's actually getting the money, and also with the customer doing the request for the money, that the work's actually getting done. And the next one is the performance of the project, the funding of the projects. The funding comes from a pool. This was designed on purpose so that as time goes on, the program has the ability to grow within the state, and you're not locked into one capital provider. You have the ability for multiple capital providers to compete to provide that capital at the lowest cost possible for ratepayers that participate in the program. And the next one is the actual collection of the payments. They would be through EDI, submitted to the participating EDC, who would in turn bill the customer, collect the payment, and then transfer that payment to the on-bill administrator, next slide, who the on-bill administrator would then distribute those funds to both the administrator itself from a servicing spread perspective, as well as replenishment of the principal supply from the capital pool. And then as the last item below on the bottom is a contractor qualification and physical fitness element. And I think that most utilities monitor that now. I know through the Keystone Help program, that's monitored on a regular basis to make sure that good contractors are in the program doing good things. Now, there are some details. We put together a straw man tariff for both the on-bill financing component itself and then the administrator to kind of get an idea of what it would take to make these things happen. So I think that's a brief overview of the program, the pilot program that we put together. Okay? And a couple things, since we put this program together, have happened. I've had the opportunity to visit with National Grid. National Grid, since 2009, has been running an on-bill financing program. And one thing I found out that was amazing about their program was that it's currently done very similar to direct install programs that are done in Pennsylvania. So approximately 70% of the project is paid through incentives. They offer the customer 15% discount on the remaining cash portion if they'll pay it in cash. 50% of the small business customers choose to finance that over a 12 or 24 month period of time. So there's a very significant interest by the small business customer, even though they're getting 70% paid up front, to finance that remaining portion. And they feel that's one of the reasons that's led to the success of their program. And of course, more recently, in BG&E, through the Constellation Exelon merger, there's a customer investment fund, and there's an on-bill repayment mechanism to be implemented as part of that settlement. That's the last slide, yeah.
So now, if you'd like, we can start to discuss this pilot program and the different, the Energy Savings Advanced Rider and the ESA Program Administrator Coordination Tariff. Any, what questions do you have about this program? Like what?
More quickly, if we could, I know there was mentioned there are several folks in the room that support this or help draft it. If we could have those people identify who they were and the reason for their supports and perhaps the strengths and weaknesses that those folks see within this program, I think that would be helpful.
That'd be great.
Kia strongly supports this proposal. We commented on it, and even though there's probably some details that need to be worked out in terms of whether things like the utilities prefer, I'll just carry it. Thanks. Whether the utilities would prefer that termination of service was not connected or connected to repayment of the bill, I know is a big issue, but to me that's a detail that can be looked at. Looking at Chapter 56 and making sure we're consistent with that, with those regulations, I think is an important piece that's still outstanding. But KIA supports it largely because, study after study shows that financing is a real barrier, especially to small businesses and residential for that matter, but we're not asking for that kind of pilot right now, that the small business community is the community most in need of these services and probably is best positioned to take advantage of it. So we think, again, study after study has shown that the barrier is financing. And let's face it, if a contractor goes into a home and into a business and says, you need a new HVAC system, and that's $15,000, $25,000, and there's only generally a 40% follow-through rate, even when sometimes the system is antiquated, then versus going into a business and saying, over this period of time, you'll have these monthly payments, I think you're going to see success of upgrading those systems in a non-crisis situation improve immensely and therefore help with the goals for Act 129.
Hi, Courtney Lane with Penn Future. We also support this proposal and have reviewed it previously. I'd just like to echo what Maureen said about the fact that narrowing in on the small business customer class is really important. We recently spoke with the Pennsylvania Small Business Development Center out of UPenn, and they basically verified what we had heard, that there really aren't a lot of financing options out there. The program that they found is most effective is DEP's the Advantage Grant Program. However, it's oversubscribed every year and is very popular, which only highlights further the need of this customer class to receive additional financing. And they also spoke to issues with, the fact small business customer class doesn't have a lot of time to really walk through finding other sources of financing that might be available through private sector. So we think this is very important, and we also support the fact that this is an on-bill repayment model, which we think can help put to ease some of the utilities' concerns, and we appreciate the fact that John's prepared this proposal and the fact that SEF may have some capital to put forth for a pilot. We think perhaps today we could go through the sections of this and sort of hash out what people like about it, what the concerns are, and the fact that we can really react to a proposal that's in front of us, I think will be helpful to move this working group forward.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Hopkins, president of the Sustainable Energy Fund, and obviously we support this on-bill financing. Our mission is to promote renewable energy and energy efficiency, and one of the ways that we do it is breaking down financial barriers, and we feel that this on-bill financing is a means of breaking down that barrier. So good job to everyone. Thank you.
I'm Dan Asmus with the Office of Small Business Advocate. Obviously, this pilot is targeted at our constituents. We've not been real active in this at this point, but I think it's time for us to get active. A couple of questions, I guess, at the outset. Understanding that the pilot program is geared for small C&I, I'm assuming, but maybe incorrectly, that down the road somewhere the program will eventually envelop some other rate classes, such as residentials, and I don't know, maybe even large C&I. But is that a correct assumption?
We designed the program specifically for small C&I. I don't know that it's applicable to large C&I. They have a different cost structure when it comes to accessing capital. Okay. And then when it comes to residential customers, of course, there's Chapter 56 as well as a whole litany of lending laws. So for residential customers, it may actually require some type of legislative action or action by the commission addressing Chapter 56.
Okay, so that tells me that this basically is going to be limited to small C&I.
Yes.
Okay.
This is Chris Brown from the PUC Law Bureau. I just have a question about the model. Several questions. I noticed that the administrator gets a servicing fee, and obviously the fund gets reimbursed for their costs and refurbishing of the funds. I don't see in here anything to cover EDC costs for this, administering their portion of this, and I was wondering what the intent, what have you thought about that, and what your plan is for that.
In the last rider that's in here, it actually addresses two items. It addresses both the software changes, if required, by an EDC, as well as the cost of the EDI transactions. We use PPL Electric's cost that they have established right now with their generators, EGS generators, for billing, and that was $2.34, and we put $2.35 in here, as well as we also put in there for a quarter point of the actual value of the lending to go towards the cost of modifying software for the EDC, and that we put in there that if that didn't fully cover the cost at the end of the pilot, that there should be some type of 1307 or other mechanism to recover the remainder of the cost. So the utilities are held whole on the program.
Just to follow up on that, that 235, is that a one-time recovery?
That's actually a monthly.
That's a monthly.
It's a monthly charge for the billing.
Where'd you get that from, John?
From your EGS tariff.
We don't charge EGSs for transacting EDI. We only have two charges in that tariff. One is a charge if now we kind of refer to it as the read the manual charge. So if an EGS is incompetent and we have to spend a lot of time coaching them through transactions or through training, we charge them for that. And then there's one other charge for information if it's in a non-standard format, but we don't bill EGS. I'm not sure who gave you that, and I don't recall the number anywhere in our tariff, but I'll go back and look. I mean, that was clearly a question I had.
I have a copy of it. I can send it over to you.
It's on the web, it's readily available.
That's where I got it from.
But we don't bill EGSs. That's a fact. We do not bill EGSs for transactions.
That's even better.
Well, assuming you fall under the law as an EGS, sure. having brought that up, I should tell you that we have trading partner agreements with other people we do business with that address whether there are fees or not. So, to Chris's point, we're pretty interested in full recovery. don't know, you know, where the 235 comes from. Billing system modifications are likely to be capital, and I'm not sure that a rider currently can recover those kind of capital charges under 1307. I can't think of a way it fits under the smart meter rules, although I've tried. So that strikes me as one point of concern. Absent that, then it falls back, I guess, on the ratepayers to pick up what could be some pretty expensive system modifications. And I guess if we were to consider a pilot, I think we'd probably be wise to consider, since we're just trying to prove whether the concept works, we'd probably be better off doing something manual in a pilot than doing a pilot, investing $1 million to have three people show up at the party. That probably wouldn't be the best approach.
Yeah, this is Donna Clark from the Energy Association, and just looking at this particular issue of cost recovery, because we have a whole host of concerns and questions about not only this model, what other models might be on the table. Again, the first time that we saw this model was last Thursday when it was sent out. We were not aware that there were any discussions among any of the participants for a particular model. The first time that we saw the reference material was in the last day or two. You know, I am familiar with a number of the pieces that were sent out by Laura. There's probably a couple of others that we could add to the mix, including an ACEEE study that was done this summer, 2012, that took a look at the limits of on-bill financing and some of the issues there, as well as a couple of articles looking at the programs in New York and some of the questions that the group needs to ask itself. I think most of the reference material that was put on the table so far, and I want to thank Kia for the webinar that you did in December. That was very helpful. It's, you know, too bad that last gentleman, we couldn't get to hear what he had to say. I think that was directed at the multifamily program. But I think most of the articles talk about the fact that when you start on this venture, you have to have a real clear idea of what your goal is. And that perhaps jumping to a model first and looking at a model first is a little difficult when we probably haven't had a real thorough discussion of what our goals are, particularly within the confines of Act 129, which is where this working group comes from. I noticed, John, that you talk about LDCs, and although the Energy Association has members that are LDCs or natural gas companies, LDCs are not here and haven't been part of the discussion. So I'm hoping that any pilot that would be put into place is going to be limited to EDCs and not include gas utilities unless they're at the table. I think something to think about, and something that we tried to raise in a piece that we put out in December and we circulated to the entire working group, was in the confines of Act 129, if the issue is on-bill financing or some additional financing necessary to supplement the incentives that are already available through the utility programs, i.e. rebates? Do we need something more, some on-bill financing? One of the things we need to look at is there a demand in the market? And I'm not certain that a pilot really is the only way to make sure there is that demand. I think we have a lot of anecdotal information that's been shared. I know all of our members, our EDCs that have Act 129 programs, do have stakeholder meetings that they regularly conduct. And there hasn't been that demand from the small business class at that stakeholder meetings that some sort of financing, in addition to what else is out there, is needed. I hear that we're keeping away from the residential class. Keystone Help obviously fits that need for the residential class. I'm aware of a financing program that the Sustainable Energy Fund has in place already, and I think it might be good to have some discussion on how that program is working and whether or not you have a lot of participants that are taking advantage of that program. I understand that you might work with Duquesne, or Duquesne might promote that program or have some folks that have used that program, but that could be something else to talk about. I'm concerned that we're sort of putting the cart before the horse, because we haven't had a broad discussion yet about really what the demand is before we jump into a particular model. And I know that's something I've expressed to a number of people. We're certainly not, the outline that we presented to the group, which I'm thinking everybody has seen because we did send it out to the entire group and we have copies here of our outline, was not an outline to have an academic study. We were not looking to have an academic study. We were looking to determine what is the demand. So if any of us would go to our management teams with a new business plan, something we want, a new product we want to promote, one of the things that we'd be looking to put on the table is what is the demand for the product? In the confines of Act 129, what is the demand for this product? Is there a demand, and can it be served in another way other than an on-bill repayment or on-bill financing program that's going to have a lot of costs? So circling back to Chris's question, I know if you've read the papers that people have circulated in New York, most of the utilities suggested that the cost for IT to fix their billing systems to accommodate these type of programs and add that extra line on the bill was anywhere from $1 million to $1.2 million. And I just, you know, if we're going to invest that type of money in a pilot, I think we want to be really careful that there is a demand in the market for it. And that's just the programming cost. That's not the cost of running the program and doing some of the things that was mentioned by Maureen in terms of collections. And the other thing is, if we are looking at small commercial, I don't think Chapter 56 is an issue, frankly. If we're looking at small commercial, Chapter 56 is for residential customers. So I know I just said a lot, but circling back to Chris's question about costs, I think there's going to be more costs than just $2.35 per application or per transfer of information, if I was understanding that correctly.
Hi, Dave Evans, Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency. If any of you have heard me in the past, I have this one thing I talk about, it's multifamily housing, and I won't break from that tradition today. First of all, I do appreciate the fact you have master metered multifamily considered in this piece from a pilot perspective. I will tell you, and I'll put the horse before the cart for you, is that the multifamily, we don't take advantage of the rebates very often because the rebates compared to the total cost do not really provide sufficient dollars to the owners. They try to do the rebates. We just finished a program using our funding with weatherization, and we were able to retrofit 8,300 units, 108 projects, so we've seen how it works. And for master meter deals, it's really critically important we have an on-bill financing type of approach. For most of them, this is affordable units, not the regular multifamily, but affordable. With either HUD or anything done with us, we find that there's a first mortgage there that's already in place that typically will not allow financing to come into play behind them. We've been able to do it on a few occasions with exceptions, but the ARRA funds or grants, we can put them in without a problem. Anything with a loan type structure to it, if it goes on a project, you must get HUD approval or PHFA or other some first mortgage lender to allow it behind it. So therefore, it's very difficult. What the on-bill financing does is provide a tool to allow us to get the funds necessary to the project that will then be paid back through the bill without incorporating a lien position to the project, therefore easily addressed. As to the amount of deals we have out there in our world, just between HUD and PHFA, there are 140,000 units of multifamily to deal with. Half of them will be master metered. Added to that, the Public Housing Authority have another 60,000 or so of units to add to it. So we have a ready access to move forward. So one thing I will suggest, and I don't know how far we'll get along with it, is that from the pilot perspective, the lending or the analysis in multifamily is a lot different than the C&I type of analysis. And the money we would have available, including from PHFA, would probably only be able to use for a multifamily type of product. So if at all possible, consider maybe this pilot has a two-piece to it. One would be for multifamily. It would work similar to the PFG&E or PFE&G in New Jersey with the New Jersey HMFA to consider an entity like us as the administrator of it because of the expertise we have in it to allow for that type. And we had, again, we would have ready access to come in as loans for this product. We just don't have the availability of soft grants to be able to do it at this time.
Hi, Dave. This is Kent from First Energy. You did 108 projects, I think you said,
yes,
for multifamily, and the funding came from ARRA?
Mostly, yes.
Could you tell me how much capital was involved with those projects?
Total amount that was funded?
Yes.
Probably about between 25 to 30 million. What you're going to see in a typical multifamily deal is somewhere between 200,000 to 600,000 needed. We were seeing repairs of about upgrades of about 3,000 per unit. So from a house perspective, it's not an overall, you know, it's a good, great number. 3,000 per unit, a lot less than what we expected. We did not do such things as window replacement because of the inefficiencies regarding the payback time period. But we were at average 3,000 per unit in total costs.
Just to chip in quickly on both sets of comments, in terms of the starter proposal we have here, it's something that we appreciate and we'd like to build on. We obviously the input on multifamily. I know from stakeholders from the couple years we've been doing Act 129, we've heard from municipal, township authorities, governmental authorities that would love to get involved in Act 129, but because of certain budgetary, you know, they think year to year and budgets cannot. This was an option we wanted to look in perhaps for those kind of folks, for multi-unit families, also for the small businesses. So we're going to, you know, this is the base program kind of we've been proposed here. Maybe we throw it out, maybe we build on it and add those pieces to it, but I think it's what we've been brought. And so I do appreciate that we have that and that we make sure that we get all these things in there. Because I know in the last meeting we've pretty much ruled out residential because there are so many difficulties, but we'll have to probably at some point explore that in a little greater detail to explain to the commission in the final report why we didn't go down that path. In terms of what Donna mentioned, I asked Chris to look into, try to provide a little clarity on this issue today of the focus of this group, because I understand what you're saying in terms of looking at the market, but our charge in the order was not to do a on-bill financing market potential study. I just don't think we have time to do that. And also, you know, I've seen the EDCs implement programs in Act 129 without doing a potential study. They throw it out there and nobody takes it up. The next quarter they come in, they take that program off the table and then move somewhere else. You know.
I'll take exception with that. We have put...
And, well, I've seen a lot of some programs.
Well, there
are a handful
don't
of programs
don't confuse flexibility with lack of forethought.
Well,
okay. So there are people in this room who have extensively cross-examined the programs that we filed in the first instance, and they have expected, and the ALJ has expected, and I presume the commissioners expected at the end of that record that there would be demonstration that we'd thought through those programs and had some reason to believe that they would be successful. Otherwise, we wouldn't have put them in our budget. Now, the fact that we find that we were wrong or that we had misjudged uptake or that the SWE changed the benefits formula and we were not going to make the target because of that, and we got rid of that pony and rode a different pony, doesn't mean that we didn't put forethought into that. So
yeah, I'll
I'm glad that's being recorded. Thank you.
I'll take that explanation. But, it, you know, in terms of going back and you know, Chris, I'll just turn it over to you to try to clarify. I mean, the order has two sentences to me that are fairly obvious as to what we're supposed to do.
Yes, it simply states that the working group is to identify working models of on-bill financing and on-bill payment for best practices from other states, and that's from page 51 of the implementation order if you're looking. So we're looking at models, best practices from other states. I think the emails demonstrated a lot of those. We're looking at a model now that someone's put forward. We're not saying it'll be adopted, but to look at and to further flesh it out if we can. And also to your point as far as the need, I mean, we're already hearing that's part of this group here is to identify some of the need as well. So just point you to the implementation order.
Well, I understand that, Chris. I was looking at the stakeholders encouraging the commission to convene a working group and conduct a feasibility study. And I know that Kia, in its comments to phase two implementation, would have talked about a feasibility study. And again, you know, I've read this. We're just concerned, and we've looked at some of the material from other jurisdictions where they've had programs like this in place, and they don't have an act going on. They don't have a statute in place that mandates utilities to reduce energy uses and reduce demand reduction with penalties attached. And in those states, some of those programs have not had many folks coming in and taking advantage. And so that is a concern, and I think it's a legitimate concern you have within the confines of Act 129. And I think the last working group session that we had, I think a number of the utilities raised the fact that we're not looking at this as the funds for this program coming from the Act 129 funds. You know, those funds are a very discreet source of dollars that are dedicated to phase one plans or phase two plans with certain goals. So we're not looking, utilities at this point are not looking to take those dollars and put them into an ongoing financing program. So we're looking, if this pilot goes forward, the funding is going to have to come from another source, both the capital, which I'm assuming is coming from third party.
That's correct.
As well as the cost to implement, which means you are talking about some sort of mechanism to recover those costs.
I think that's what's part of the working group, is to make those recommendations. If the EDC community feels that that should go into the working group report, then that would go into the working group report. And other folks can propose recovery mechanisms as they wish. I think to shut it down right now,
We are not suggesting, by no means are we suggesting shutting anything down. We're just looking to make sure that we cover all the issues and thoughtfully and as a group discuss them in an open forum, such that if at the end of the day there can be a model that there is a consensus for, we'd be able to develop that.
And I know that there seems to be a little bit of an edge with this side of the table where you think that we're going to impose this on you. I don't see anything in the order or anything that the folks on this side of the table have said that we're going to adopt this model and you're going to implement it. We're going to make recommendations to the commission. If the commission comes out and says, this is a viable tool for your toolbox and for the ratepayers, you should consider it as part of your plan. You can decide to use it or not use it. Maybe the commission does order it. I don't know. But we are making recommendations on a model to them. They will decide whether they impose it on you, how you recover it. We're giving them the options on the models, on potential avenues they can recover it. If the commission decides that you will recover it as part of your Act 129 or outside, it's their decision, and we're going to try to lay all those options out to the commission. We have to. That's my charge as a staffer.
And we understand that.
I wanted to just respond to Donna's initial question about the demand for on-bill financing among the commercial sector. I am no expert here, so this is just what I know, which is that much of the funding that was used, the ERA funding that Dave Evans referred to in Philadelphia, was used for small commercial building loans. And those were principally grants. So the small commercial building sector has been addressed in the last few years in Pennsylvania because of the stimulus funding with grant programs. And there were the difficulty in servicing the small commercial sector is that the size of the loan is so small that it's very difficult to recover. So, for example, in the Energy Works program, this is a federally funded U.S. Department of Energy EECBG Better Buildings program. There's both a commercial side and a residential side to this program. ECA administers the residential program, and that is supported by the Keystone Help Loan, a really excellent, excellent product. But the commercial building program is administered by the Reinvestment Fund, and Roger Clark, who was here last meeting, spoke to this a little bit. Again, the minimum loan in the commercial building side is $100,000. You must take $100,000. That's the minimum. His average loan is $1 million, right? There is no small business in this state who wants to borrow $100,000 to improve their energy systems. So the difficulty with the commercial sector is that conventional lending, and I think the expert in the room is Dave Evans, who can, you know, correct me if I've said anything out of school here. But the difficulty is that conventional lending cannot support these small transactions. And the commercial building sector lending is really focused on big borrowers. The other problem with the Energy Works commercial loan is they don't permit multiple buildings to pool together. So you couldn't get a whole bunch of Wawas or a whole bunch of, you know, 7-Elevens or a whole bunch of mom and pops to pool together. It has to be a single entity. And I don't know the reasons for that. As I say, I'm not an expert. But I do know that, you know, there are a lot of people in Pennsylvania who have been looking hard at the commercial sector, trying to improve energy efficiency, and have not come up with good financing for this sector. They're excellent products for big commercial buildings, excellent products, lots of options, but almost no options for the small commercial lender. And I think another place to look at for demand is the state's own small business program that has been in place for decades, that's been administered by the DEP, and it's pollution prevention. I don't forget the exact name of the program. Courtney, you probably know the name of the program. PPA, so Pollution Prevention Assistance. And right now it's administered in our region by Wharton, I think, by the University of Pennsylvania. Is that right? Anyway, as soon as those funds are put out on the street, they're gone. There's so much demand for this. It's essentially a grant program. But there's tremendous demand, but there really isn't the product for the commercial sector. And I think Donna's question is a very appropriate one, and I think it is one that the committee should really dive into. And because I think in diving into that, we will learn how to best structure the program design to meet the demand. And I think, you know, it's a very valid point.
Can I ask Liz a question then on that? So what is it about this program that it sounds like there's capital? I mean, John's got capital. I'm hearing that there's other capital. And I'm hearing that the market isn't being served because capital doesn't want a bunch of little loans because I guess the overhead on them is high. How does this proposal actually solve that problem? Because you've still got an administrator administering individual loans. I guess I'm not a loan guy. I'm just a dumb mechanical engineer, and I don't get it. So help me.
It has to do with the way the underwriting's done. Utility bill payment is a very good predictor of energy efficiency loan payment. So if someone's been paying their utility bills on time for the past 24 months, they generally continue to do that payment, and default rates are less than 3% in these programs. Some programs are less than 1% for their default rate. So when it comes to capital, your underwriting requirements are much simpler, and the ability to pool that capital together, to bundle it, to do what AFC, for example, is doing right now. They're selling off their first portfolio that the state of Pennsylvania has been bundling for the last several years, and getting that portfolio into the secondary market where it's traded. Those transactions bring you the lowest cost of capital, so you got the cost of capital on one side, and the other side, what you have is those underwriting requirements. Sustainable Energy Fund, for example, in general, we don't start looking at loans until they're above $25,000, $35,000. Just due to the cost of underwriting alone, going through the typical process of examining 3 years of federal tax returns, the owner's income information. It becomes a costly endeavor. And the demand, we see the demand out there. We worked with Dave Defy, who's in the back of the room, along with All Facilities, on a program that dealt with the utility rebates. And there was a little bit of a consternation on some of the small business folks that they couldn't afford to lay out the money and then wait for the rebate. So we worked with them to put together a, what we called an instant rebate or upfront rebate program. We provided the money upfront at a discount rate. And then they were able to utilize that program to go ahead, do the construction, do everything they needed to do. And then the utility pays us the rebate directly. That program's been very successful.
But that's not what you're proposing.
No, no, that's a completely...
We're not doing any rebate.
That's a separate program, but it starts to get into that same ball of wax as dollar numbers. These rebates tend to be very small, some as low as $500. But we're able to do that because of the difference in the underwriting requirements. We could never underwrite a $2,000 loan for a customer.
If I boil what you just said down, it sounds like the key thing that EDCs or LDCs may have to add to this process to grease the skids, if you will, is payment histories.
Yes.
Well, there's a lot simpler models than this for us to get you payment histories.
Well, also the bill itself.
Yeah, the bill itself is the most important.
The bill is, so tell me a little bit more about why the bill is that important.
Was this, at least from a multifamily perspective, when...
Yeah, I'm sorry, did you say an academic perspective?
No, I'm sorry, multifamily perspective. You take a development.
I still didn't get you.
Multifamily,
thank you.
Multi-units, whatever.
I got
yeah.
it, sorry.
What's so important about that, it doesn't require a lien on the property. And that's where so much of the time it creates havoc for us trying to do something to a development, provide energy retrofitting to be done. The grant allowed us an aspect where we could get it done without that problem. But if you need to put a lien on a property, in a typical multifamily development, you have a lender. You also have limited partners limited partnership. And there are certain requirements. They would have to all go through approval of that. Plus, a lender would have to allow a second lien behind it. Or if there are many multifamily deals, a fifth lien behind it. Because so many of the ones we do have several soft liens behind them already. What the process through a billing requirement does for us, either through a service agreement or the tariff, is that there's not a lien going and gone to the property. There's an agreement with the owner, but there's not a lien. Therefore, the caveat we have, the stick you have, quite frankly, is that bill that's being paid to the utility company. They don't pay the bill. There are certain downfalls may accrue to the project because of that. So you have a stick at the same time without having to have a lien position on it. So it's really quite critical from our perspective to have that capability.
So it's not the bill, it's the termination rights that go with the bill, is really what you're saying,
yes.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Although just a question on that, and I'm not a lender, but given that in the pilot recommendation, we're saying that the loan stays with the meter, would that not encumber the deed on the property?
It's not a loan that stays with the meter, I believe it's a tariff or a service agreement, correct?
That's correct. There's been some IRS rulings on bill financing, and it's not interpreted as a loan. And that is a big deal with commercial entities of whether it is or is not a loan.
So it's not a loan, but if the small business would sell the building, that obligation goes to the next owner.
Yeah, very similar. I don't know if PICO has an area expansion surcharge. But very similar, gas companies do it a lot. They'll have an area expansion surcharge. And if someone comes in, they build a house, they're part of that area expansion surcharge and then decide to move on 2 or 3 years later, that area expansion surcharge may exist for 10 years, and it follows the meter.
We don't have that.
Yeah. Okay. The utility I come from in South Florida, on the gas side, for example, we sold appliances and did on-bill financing
that's
and repayment.
That's not allowed in Pennsylvania.
I understand yeah. It's not allowed. But I'm saying the mechanism is used down there quite effectively, and it does work.
If I could add one thing to that, most on-bill financing repayment programs are done with the retrofits earning sufficient savings to be able to pay the bill off without an impact on the development. And that's critical here. There are some recommendations you do more than that, but quite frankly, we've always maintained that you only do a repayment that can happen within a 10-year time period, and therefore not impact the development's cash flow in any way.
So you're looking for bill neutrality? Are you hoping that the projects will have bill neutrality? In other words, the payment that is being made to pay back the loan, so to speak, is coming out of the savings that you're... Okay, so this pilot is bill neutral.
Yes, in fact, it's actually spelled out directly in the two riders, and it's spelled out as far as how much someone can borrow based on that, so they can obtain approximately 20% savings decrease.
And so if the obligation runs with the meter, so to speak, is it that's what you're suggesting, and it's a commercial property, not all small commercial entities own their own property, but it's a commercial property, and that business moves or fails, and the property stays vacant for a while, how is that covered during that time frame? Is there some sort of reserve fund that you set up?
No,
who then bears the risk of that failure?
That's the risk of the capital providers.
So the capital, not the utility, the
Correct.
Capital provider.
It's the risk of the capital providers.
Yeah, that
go ahead, Chris.
I just that goes to my part of my question here is I understand why there's loan providers, capital providers put a lien on a property, secure the loan so they can have guaranteed some sort of guarantee of recovery to reduce their risks. In this situation, how are you handling the risks of default to account for these types of issues?
We handled the risk of default through two mechanisms. Obviously, first, the on-bill repayment. In the history, if you look at these programs with very low default rates. And we handled that by looking at the previous payment history that the customers had with the utility. That's number one. The second way that we addressed the risk of default was actually by splitting the dollar amount. So we looked at the dollar amount as part of it, and we said if you were below, I can't remember if we ended up at 25 or 35,000, but if you were below X dollars on the loan, you would go through the one underwriting process. If you were above that, you would go through a more traditional underwriting process.
I don't understand what you mean by above or below. What amount? What money are you talking about?
I'll tell you right now where it is.
I think it's on page 4, John.
It was 35,000 draft.
It was 35,000.
Yeah, 35,000, page 4, item C, customer eligibility. And what that does is it allows you to spread that risk of default over a greater number of people. I'll use the instant rebate program as a great example. On the instant rebate program, we don't place a UCC filing or anything against the participants in that program. What actually helps with the default rate in that program is that we're spreading the risk out among tens and hundreds of people. So you're getting into a societal default rate instead of just individual credits where you may only have 10 loans or 20 loans. It's very simple, similar to venture capital investing, of where you don't invest in 4 or 5 projects. You invest in 50 projects or 60 projects knowing that you're going to have 1 or 2 fail, but the remainder of the projects financially cover that loss.
Okay, so this dollar you're talking about, this 35, is that the... No. And what is that? It says energy savings advances. What do you mean? Is that the amount of savings that's predicted by the...
That energy savings advance is just what we call the value of the loan that would be given to the customer.
Okay.
We just call it an energy savings advance.
Okay, so that's how much the money they need to put in the...
Correct.
The loan amount they want. Okay.
But I believe, John, you just mentioned thousands or... tens of thousands of customers,
And when I look through the information in the ACEEE report, I mean, most of these programs, I think there was 20 states involved, and most of these programs look to do 200 customers, 300 customers. So is there a bit of a disconnect there when you're talking about thousands of customers versus a couple hundred?
No, I believe the market is available in Pennsylvania, and many of these programs are also capital limited. This program we designed specifically with a capital pool, so there'd be multiple providers. When you look into the programs, you got to look at where they got their original funding from. Some of these programs may have been funded through the Stimulus Act, and they're limited on the dollar amount. Other programs may be funded through the utility, and the utility has a total capital amount they don't want to exceed. There's a lot of variables that go into this. It goes into whether the utility is being forced to do it. So are they doing it happily and gleefully and executing it, you know, to its most extent, or is it on the last page in their website and it's really, you know, the participants have to dig to find it to participate in it. So there are a lot of variables to go into the success or failure of the program.
Okay. And one more question. I think, Liz, you mentioned AFC. And, I mean, I guess from my perspective, I believe that program is a success. It sounds like it was described here as a success. But I don't believe any of those charges go onto the customer's bill. So I would consider that maybe off-bill financing, but a program that's very successful. Most of the utilities, I believe actually all the utilities, promote Keystone Help through their energy efficiency programs.
Right, but just to clarify, AFC, Keystone Help, is only residential, and it's only owner-occupied. It's only homeowners who qualify.
Okay, and I guess my point would be that the program is successful. Maybe that model could be move to small commercial industrial without, you know, involving the EDCs, other than the EDCs helping with the relationship and being the conduit for customers that want to participate in energy efficiency, you know, provide them with the information and help the third party along.
Right. Well, I can't speak for Peter Kreisa, but I work very closely with them, and I know that the city of Philadelphia, for example, has been trying to get Peter into commercial lending for years, and it's very difficult for, and I guess, John, I mean, you would be able to articulate this better than I can, but it's very difficult for the commercial lender. Here can't easily move into the commercial sector. AFC really can't easily transition.
Yeah, and we've talked to Treasury and AFC, and what they told us, because I thought, you know, Keystone Help is very successful in the residential market. And what we were told by Treasury, and I'm, you know, obviously not trying to put words in their mouth, and AFC, is the risk of non-payment is too high. And that's one of the reasons that they can't go into that market. So what I'm understanding from you is you're thinking that that risk that AFC and those type of programs believe is too high is minimized or ameliorated by the fact that your charge is on the bill. You know, and again, I have not read all of the information that was circulated, but I certainly was familiar with a lot of it because obviously we've been looking at it too. And I'm also wondering. I'm not sure that that risk really is minimized just by this and that the utility is held harmless. I'm not getting the connection between what you're suggesting and the risk in making these loans to this group of people that, from what I'm hearing,
The
historical commercial lenders aren't willing to go into that marketplace, and that's why you want to suggest an on-bill financing program where the protection is the fact that it's on the utility bill.
Yeah, what we're looking... Oh, go ahead.
Pat is actually with the Department of Treasury. Perhaps you could assist a little bit before you respond.
All right.
Yeah, I can't really actually speak to whether
commercial lending for energy efficiency is any riskier than for the residential market. The predominant reason that Treasury isn't willing to go into the commercial lending space, or hasn't been thus far, is the cost per project is much, much higher, so we have a lot less diversification. It's riskier, not necessarily that there will be more defaults, but a similar number of defaults is going to take a bigger bite out of the amount that you've lent, because each project is larger. So it's the risk is more concentrated as the capital supplier. So that's predominantly our thing. For AFC, again, I can't speak for them, but I don't know that they necessarily think commercial lending is riskier. It's just a much more complicated underwriting procedure. So for residential lending, you know, you go in with a cutoff for the debt-to-income ratio of the borrower, of a FICO score. And then you're really just creating a matrix, and it's very easy to run someone through. They can approve someone in 30 minutes for a Keystone Help loan for residential. With underwriting a commercial loan, you have to look at the books of the business. There's a lot more factors. So I don't know that it's necessarily a riskier loan as it is. It's just a more complicated procedure that AFC has no expertise in.
And so, John, you feel confident that you'll be able to get lenders or participants to come in and provide that money, even though they're not going to go through the traditional credit analysis?
A year and a half ago now, ACEEE held a conference specifically focused on energy efficiency financing in Boston, and there were multiple capital providers that are very interested and have been repeated contacts, that they're very interested in getting into this market, but they don't make the loans directly. In other words, you take someone like Deutsche Bank, they're not going to make a loan for $2,000 directly, but they will provide $25 million in a pool of capital that they'll get repaid from, and they will take a certain amount of risk associated with that based on what the return is. So capital providers are in the market. The secondary market for energy efficiency has been very tough to come by, but through PA Treasury and through the work of Peter, we're finally at the point where that secondary market on the residential side is beginning to form, is beginning to take hold. But you have to reach a certain volume to get there. Before those capital providers are willing and ready to step up to the plate, so to speak. So it's really the utility is not at risk of non-payment. It's the capital providers that's at risk of non-payment, as well as the administrator. So those are the folks that are sharing the risk of non-payment, not the utility. The utility is there to act as a collection mechanism for the payment, in other words, to bill and collect that bill. And the idea is, as long as the energy savings drive the total utility bill, including the value of the loan, below what the previous amount was, if that customer's paid for the last 2 years their utility bill on time every month, then you have a reasonable belief that they're going to continue to pay that bill that is now lower than their previous bill. So when you combine that together with the reduced cost of underwriting, you can develop a model that is, we would say, is economically neutral at this point. You need larger volume than what the pilot's talking about to become very lucrative for anybody to be involved in, but it's economically neutral. The capital providers aren't going to make any money, but they're not going to lose their shirts either.
Going back to the model, as far as for, again, risk of default to address this, I notice your eligibility talks about past performance. Are there any forward-looking performance or tests that you could apply, things that such as tie the facility to ongoing occupancy or something to that nature?
For the under 35,000, we tried to focus purely on the utility bill. We wanted to streamline the process. Anything over that 35,000, we looked at doing through a more traditional underwriting process where you would look at both their historical financial performance as well as their future what you expect their future performance to be, debt service coverage ratio, leverage ratio. And at that point, you may actually require especially if it's a significant amount of money, some type of arrangement with the owner of the building.
So go back to your model here. That's encompassed under lender approval. Is that what you meant by
yes,
that?
Yes, by lender approval, exactly.
Okay.
More strenuous.
Just a couple of things. The pilot program, is there a length that this pilot program would run? Because I'm assuming that what we're trying to do is proof of concept here, right? So is it a year? Is it 2 years? What is the length that would be recommended?
I would recommend a length of 18 months. And I think that would be very similar, perhaps, to what utilities look at with EE&C programs. By the time you get it laid out there, you get it put to market, the market is aware of the program, and it starts to uptake the program.
Okay.
You'll be looking at a period of time.
18 months, and then just I think whether it's this model or another model, we should set out some discrete measures of success to dictate whether the pilot was successful and then that warrants a full commercialization or not. And the purpose of the pilot is a little bit high level in at this point. So I think it would be helpful if as a team or we take another shot at being very specific as to what the objectives are and what are the quantitative criteria that would say, yeah, this pilot was successful or no, it wasn't.
I think that's one of the things we could probably have marked down as a follow-up between the next meetings is to try to refine this. And ideally we would have liked to have two or three different models to discuss today, but and because we're having such a nice, fruitful discussion with this one model, I don't want to discourage anybody from bringing anything else thinking that this is it. I think maybe if some folks thought, well, maybe I was going to introduce an Illinois model or something, but I didn't want to. And now you see the discussion. Maybe you want to bring something to us, and certainly send those to us and to Laura, and to we will definitely entertain other models. We don't want this to be the be-all, end-all. Hopefully maybe this starts discussions that we have a spin-off of this or something like that.
Yep. And then just one other detail that got the attention of my senior management is the application of payments. The way it's written here, that will be a very hard sell to our company.
I actually went to our counsel, who used to be with OTS, and asked him to write down what he thought was the appropriate application of payments. And so he went through the statutes and looked at it and said, well, you know, first, obviously, it should be the utility bill. And then any other charges, and then the loan payment would be the last item paid. But then when they go ahead and pay the next month, that should continue to pile on to the previous month to put pressure on that occupant to pay. But we also, the way we wrote the tariff, we wrote a loophole in there for the utility. We didn't say the utility shall or had to terminate. We left it to the utility discretion as to whether to terminate the customer or not. I understand where you're coming from. The meter's a cash register and the money's got to come in. But at the same time, we need to provide something to the capital providers that we can use to make sure we keep, you know, if the program transitions from a pilot to a full-blown program, that you can use to keep the cost of capital low.
Well, that's one way to look at it.
I was going to say.
I'm just suggesting that the, applying in subsequent months for PICO to be able to look at this and to roll something out, any payment, any customer that's in arrears from the utility charges has got to be paid first regardless. And I'll just throw that out.
Yeah,
if you
think about the fact that a lot of utilities have purchase of receivable programs today.
That's right.
A lot of utilities, in fact, I think all the utilities have purchase of receivable programs. So they're already putting the cash out to pay a supplier.
Right.
You know, you've got to recover that. That's definitely something that is going to be problematic. Because, again, this is just another program you want a utility to run in addition to a lot of other
obligations that it has related to, you know, the competitive market and the retail competitive market.
Well, there is some benefit you're getting as part of your Act 129 compliance with this. So that it's not like you'd be imposed and be have told you're going to run this and not get any benefit. But Tanya, you had a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to add 2 points. The application of payment also jumped out at me. And what you're really doing through the application of payment is you are creating a utility uncollectible, because in the second month, you've taken money and you've applied it to a past due loan repayment, which means the money's not being applied to the utility bill. So you are going to create a utility uncollectible, which is going to impose costs on other customers. And as Donna was saying, there's another provision in here regarding that the utility must forward the payment. Whether it receives it or not, it must forward the payment. There was a provision that said that in here.
Oh, I just wrote it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say, if you have to forward the payment, whether you receive it or not, you're creating, at a minimum, a cash working capital requirement on the utility until such time as they can either stop the payment forwarding or until such time as they recoup the payment. So we have to be really careful that if the intent of this is to not impose costs on other on regulated utility customers, there are a couple of these payment provisions that would do it. The other thing I just wanted to add is, you know, termination for non-payment of the loan, you know, is a fairly drastic measure. And again, on the small commercial side, I'm not going to speak for Dan, but in the multifamily housing situation, if a multifamily housing owner is terminated, it's a whole lot of residential customers, many of whom are low income, that are perhaps without service, oftentimes at very cold times of the year. So this is not, I mean, this is a serious consequence that has to be given a tremendous amount of thought, even on the small commercial side. It's going to affect a lot of homes, you know, a lot of folks that have no control over whether or not that bill is being paid. So I just wanted to make sure that issue doesn't go away. I did have a question, though, if I could pose it. I was looking at the interest rates, and I understand the difficulty in small businesses obtaining loans, that what you're saying is there's no one who... There aren't many entities out there who want to commercially go into this market, but was it the intent of these interest rates to at least reflect market? It seems as if they're 6 to 8% with origination fees added on to that of 1.25%. Can the small commercial customer get a loan that's less interest within the market?
In the current market for energy efficiency and conservation loans, the simple answer is no. The market rates are north of 10%. But there are ways, like, for example, when you're refinancing a building, to incorporate that into a mortgage that has a significantly lower interest rate, but that's a different product. At the same time, some businesses use a working capital loan to finance a project, but then they have the issue with clearing it out at the end of the year and leaving a zero balance. So there's a variety. Also, in developing this, I had worked with AFC First, and I wanted to make sure that we put the variance on the interest rate so that there was room in there for a third-party administrator to come in and assume the program. You know, we developed it with the idea that this could eventually go to be from a pilot to a regular program, and what would we need to have into it early on in order to be able to do that. The other thing is that in energy efficiency, these products pay for themselves. So the interest rate doesn't affect. We find in the loans that we do, the interest rate has very little impact on the actual volume of the loans. We ran a 1.5% loan program with the city of Allentown, and it made no difference in the uptake rate for small businesses when it came to that particular loan.
Just one thing again, multifamily, we could probably bring money to the table around the 4 to 5% rate. So it's why, again, why I would like to see some separation of the two.
Just I agree with Donna and Frank and Tanya on the that stuck out as a payment thing. Because we have some great comments, I'm not going to ask everybody to supply a 10-page comment sheet, but we have this electronically, right? And if people could just put little bubble comments next to the section with like a sentence or a word as to what their concerns were, I mean, we'll know from the conversation what it was, but just to have it, I think that would be very helpful. One of the questions I'd like to propose to the group is to tie this in. I mean, this is an Act 129 requirement of this working group, and what I just asked Chris was, if we're going to do, hypothetically, if we do an on-bill financing, and it's some company A that comes in, and they do all the financing, and the utility just puts it on the bill. If I went to, and I'm company A, and I go to a small business and say, I would like to retrofit something in your, and they say, great, that 2% interest rate is great, I'm going to replace all this stuff, and they go ahead and do that. Absent a rebate from you guys, you're not going to get any credit for that in Act 129. So my question is, should we be looking and making it a requirement, if you become an on-bill financing person, that the on-bill financing only goes to those who have already come and said, look, I got X amount of rebate proposed to me by a utility to get something done. It's just not enough to get me to do it. But if you guys have financing that may be able to help me out, maybe a low interest loan plus the rebate may be enough to do it for me, and you combine those two together, should we be restricting, if we go with on-bill financing, should it be restricted to stuff that's tied to Act 129, or should they just be able to come in and do what they want? I mean, I'm going to propose that to the group, because obviously we're trying to move Act 129 along, but there's a possibility that financing people may want nothing to do with Act 129, just pass it through on the bill for me.
I thought I understood that. Well, again, this is in the confines, you know, in Act 129, and I thought I read someplace in the proposal that the rebate, that was what they were expecting, that the small commercial customer would get the rebate, and then the rebate would then be applied, I'm assuming, to the principal of the loan right up front. So whether it's $500, $1,000, or $10,000 rebate, because there are custom programs that provide substantial rebates, that would go right into paying down.
I guess, but and then you can address whether that's the case or not, but does it have to be? Are there energy efficiency programs that somebody may bring and finance that is not in a PICO or Duquesne or PPL portfolio?
Well, I think it would become a custom measure. It wasn't clearly a prescriptive measure. You could create a custom measure, but I mean, I do think that my understanding was, since this is coming out of the Act 129 Phase 2 implementation order, that yes, this is going to be put into place, and to the extent that you would have a utility who would say, I would volunteer for the pilot, I'm sure the expectation, not speaking for my members, but I'm sure the expectation would be yes, that they're going to get savings that is going to help them meet the targets.
So I guess implementation is, which is the chicken and which is the egg? How does this get implemented? Does the utility go and say, I'm going to give you a rebate, and then the financer comes in? Do they partner? Does the finance, how does this traditionally roll out?
Traditionally, in this type of mechanism, it actually lies with the contractor. It's amazing, the contractor is that first point of contact. So, for example, let's say it's a small business that has a small boiler, and the boiler's gone out. The actual point of contact is the contractor that goes out there. That's the guy that's got to know about both the utility rebate that might be applicable to that specific boiler, as well as any program to finance that. Otherwise, what happens is that customer needs that boiler up right away, and they will pay whatever it takes for that interim repair instead of replacing that unit with a more efficient unit. So I hope that answers that question. On the other question, it is written in there that if it was a rebate, that would automatically, on the technical side, that automatically qualify. There was a technical qualification and a financial qualification. And on the technical side, if there was a rebate associated with the project, it would automatically qualify the project on the technical side. But we also, based on input from Liz Robinson and Kia, added some other measures that based on revisions to the 2013 TRM may save, for example, municipal governments 15-20% on their lighting bill, there may not be a rebate there for it because they may only be going to T8 lighting and they may have T12 now with magnetic ballasts. So, for example, they're going to be significantly reducing their bill, but there's a question about whether, and Joe may be able to speak to it a little better than me, but a question about whether they would actually receive a rebate for that because of the T8 becoming code.
I wouldn't get it.
So just follow up on that. So the technical side of this, approval of these loans would be checking to see, you know, confirming the savings based on the Act 129 protocols or on an independent protocol?
You would actually have both. Obviously, if they're going to receive a rebate from the utility, they would automatically qualify on the technical side.
So, but that goes to Darren's question. I guess your proposal or what's out here right now would be applicable to non-Act 129 measures as well, is what you're saying?
Correct, but we wrote in, like, for example, their lighting would have to be reduced a minimum of 25%. Their HVAC consumption would have to be reduced a minimum of 20%.
Well, why wouldn't those be Act 129? Again, Act 129, you have the technical reference manual, which contains prescriptive measures, but anybody can come in and do a custom measure. So I'm not understanding that question, well, that, or maybe I'm not following.
Well, the technical side may be that Act 1, the TRM, the new baselines because of lighting standards have changed, may not.
Well, if what the technical reference manual does is keep up with, you know, what is acceptable in the industry for energy efficiency, it's hard to imagine that if it didn't pass the protocol of Act 129, that somehow it would be okay and considered.
If the Act 129 said, in order to get credit for a lighting rebate, you have to show 20% savings, but now we raise the baseline, now that same measure may only get 15% savings, and it may not qualify for the, you know, or other way around.
That's right. It's a baseline issue. But Darren, to your point, I think that if this is rolled out under the guise of Act 129, I think you bring up a great point, and that application for the loan should be accompanied by an Act 129 rebate application. And if there isn't one, then there shouldn't be a loan.
If I may add to that, I think it's important that, especially again, I apologize for multifamily bent, but it's what I am. With, I think, any development we look at, they should definitely be going after the rebates, but there are certain energy improvements being made that may not be something you can provide a rebate for. For instance, we go through and replace HVAC, we may have to go through and take care of ventilation at the same time to be able to fit what we're putting. That's not necessarily part of something rebate, but it is something that would go into, I see, as an energy loan type of product.
I'm not suggesting that only rebated items should be
sure.
Loaned.
Okay, good. That's why I was going
to clarify. I'm suggesting that there needs to be an Act 129 rebate associated with the
Agreed.
Loan, and then however big the loan is, and it covers what, you know.
Thank you. Yeah. And one clarification, Ken, to your question before about the number, about the dollar amount, capital was $25 million that we did, not 28. So.
Okay. Thanks.
Right, I just want to say I agree with the sense of these last comments. One of the things that we've looked at in OBF programs, and I believe the best example is the one that Keystone Help administers. The program is very narrow. It only supports very specific measures. And because it's too prescriptive and too narrow, people can't use it. You know, no, there's very little demand for this program. So I think we need to be careful in, you have to remember this is a loan and the customer is the driver, really. The customer is taking out the loan and the customer is doing this in order to meet their needs, you know. So to John's point, if he's got a boiler that broke, that's what's driving him to consider a broader range of measures. So I think the sense of this last discussion is perfect, that it has to be coupled with the Act 129 program and the rebates, and the more thought you give that and make it easy for the customer to complete all of these applications at the same time, make it very simple, make it very streamlined, make it real clear to the customer from the outset, and financially it works much better for the customer, but not restrict the loan only to measures which are in the TRM, as Donna has said. You know, this can be a custom measure if it, you know, if there's a way to qualify it under a Utilities Act 129 program. But just think, you cannot make these program won't work if it's too narrow, is our experience in looking at these programs.
Yeah, I think either having it as a TRM or a custom measure, but something definitely associated with Act 129. My greatest fear in something like this would be somebody in an emergency situation puts in a boiler and it goes through an on-bill financing thing, which is slightly more efficient than what they had before, but nowhere near as efficient as what Act 129 would require. That does not reflect well on us to have a bill repayment go through Frank's bill that's not as efficient as it should be. So I think we, as a group, if there's anybody that believes that it should not be tied with Act 129, please state so.
Well, going back to that point, I just want to understand, figuring out, again, approval of these loans and the size of the loan that will be approved is part of the, we talked about bill neutrality, so there is the amount of savings tied to this as well, right?
That's correct.
And how, do you know, something I know that I promoted in some speeches I've given to, like, the municipal and Boroughs Association is the Guaranteed Savings Act that Pennsylvania already has in place. You know, I know this pilot is for commercial, small commercial entities, but I thought I saw in some of the material, maybe it was that it's the explanation you provided, John, the idea that this might be available to other groups of customers. And you know, I think one of the things we should do, that the group should consider, is kind of laying out some of the already available tools that we have in Pennsylvania in this report. That might not only serve this group well and the commissioners well, but to the extent that it would then create a document that at least outlines some of those other tools available. And I've been surprised, and I know this is a little off topic, but I've been surprised when I have had an opportunity to do some speaking in front of those sorts of groups, that they don't seem to be aware of that statute, or they don't use it, and that to me is a great example of legislation that's on the books that's available for nonprofits and schools and governmental entities, and it's the Guaranteed Savings Program, and it is this sort of idea that you then pay for all of those improvements by the savings. You know, so that might be something else to think. I do think there are tools already in the market that are available to help eliminate some of these barriers. And, you know, we always want to be careful because of some of the other discussions going on at the commission that we're not creating programs that then become competition for existing private entities that already fill that niche. You know, that's something that we have to be a little bit careful about. It's a little off topic, but
that's something that you mentioned in the last meeting, and I thought it was a good suggestion, because I, like we said, when we ultimately give this to the commissioners, they're going to have to decide whether they want to get rid of this, encourage it, mandate it, and I thought the idea of telling them here's 22 off-bill financing methods that are available or some other things, so that they can decide whether this is critical to achieving 129 or if it's just another tool. I thought that was a great suggestion. My question to you is, how do we go about implementing getting that list together? Is that something that your team or that these team, how do we get that list and say, here, commission, here's 22 things that are available?
Well, I would think that'd be something we would put in the report. That's
well, I mean, I agree with that. How do we get that stuff listed so we can put it in the report?
Well, I think we would just all provide that information for the report. I mean, I'm mentioning one right now, and Keystone Help is another one, and The Sustainable Energy Fund already has a program.
Yeah, isn't that already on the utility websites?
Yeah, it's
part of 129.
Yeah. Part of Act 2029 requires the EDCs to put alternative federal and existing federal and state funding programs on the website. But we can supplement.
That, right?
Well, if there is more, they should be providing that. But and we can. I don't. I'm not saying we shouldn't add that to this this report. We can include that.
I think it's a great suggestion. If the folks here want to supply to our folks the list of other financing that's available, so that we can send it back out to the group, or you send it all to the group, I think it's critical that we compile that list for the final report and tell everybody on-bill financing is one of tools of many. Here are the other tools that you may or may not be aware of, and let the commissioner see that.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly can start to compile it.
I think that would be great.
If I can just jump in really quickly, sorry to interrupt. We already started compiling a list to that end, and surprisingly, there aren't that many options. But really quickly, to address the GISA program, I mean, the hand-holding that the GISA program used to offer is now somewhat defunct. So I think there's two things there. There's the scale of the loans, I think, that you see with energy savings contracting that we wouldn't be looking at for small commercial. And then there's the element of hand-holding that a lot of the municipalities need to enter into some of those contracts. But to get back to on-bill financing, you know, we already mentioned the DEP Advantage program, and that was oversubscribed by 10% of the available funding that was available for 2012. So I think that does suggest demand. And then for the PPAA program, which is a partnership between DEP and DCED, that application process is tremendously cumbersome, as we've received feedback from the Small Business Association at Wharton at Penn. And I think something that shouldn't go unsaid around on-bail financing is the ease that it allows for small businesses. They do not have a lot of extra hours in the day to go through rigorous application processes. So I think that it's a basic concept, but we shouldn't forget it when we're talking about on-bail financing. Furthermore, and I think this has been said, some of the other funding opportunities that are available from some of the sustainable energy funds, just their minimum is simply too high for the small businesses that I think we're wanting to involve. Furthermore, you know, this isn't a new idea, and the interest has been there for some time. Christopher Lynch, who was the director at the Pennsylvania Small Business Development Center, testified in front of Congress in 2007 about the need for additional capital and the ease of access to that capital. And he spoke specifically about on-bill financing in 2007 and thought that it would be applicable to small businesses in Pennsylvania. That's something I'd be happy to share. So we have been looking at what's out there. And surprisingly, there doesn't seem to be a lot right now, particularly, I think, for the subset of small businesses that are out there and are looking for money, as evidenced by the Advantage Grant program that DEP offers.
And we would agree. I mean, I'm not talking about public funding. I mean, when you read all the articles on on-bill financing, one of the issues you ask is how can you leverage public funding? This is my understanding of on-bill financing is you're not using public dollars, you're using private dollars. And obviously, with the economy the way it is, there is limits to what public funding can provide. You know, we understand that. But there are other tools available out there, and I think we have to think about those.
And I just have a question for SEF. Why is the minimum loan 100,000. I mean, is there a way to make a change?
I think it's 35,000.
25 to 35,000. It has to do with the underwriting requirements. We do other programs, such as the instant rebate program, that has a significantly lower dollar amount. But it has to do with the actual when you underwrite a loan, it's an extensive process, and it does require a lot of effort on behalf of both our organization as well as the small business that's participating in that loan.
And I'm not a banker, but I'm just trying. What I'm having a hard time is understanding is if a sustainable energy fund is putting a minimum on their loans because of the underwriting requirements. You know, I'm looking at all the literature. I'm not seeing that we're going to have the readily available capital. If you're
if you're looking for capital outside of the utilities, that's the part of this that I'm just not understanding.
You mean the various capital sources that are out in the market?
Yeah.
The capital sources are there, provided a program's there for them to participate in. These capital sources are just not direct investors. So in other words, they're not entities that are going to directly give loans to an end user unless they're very large. So that, you know, they're not going to do a loan. Let's say someone does a lighting project that's $10,000. It's a direct install, and they're left with $3,000 to pay after the rebate. They're not going to do that loan for $3,000. But they will do a pool of, you know, Hannon Armstrong comes in at about 5 mil. Deutsche Bank comes in slightly higher than that. Wells Fargo comes in. Bank of America. And they've all made public commitments to fund as a capital provider programs. But they don't want to be the actual lender in the program.
So then the administrator becomes the lender.
Yeah, they become the administrator, and you work with a capital pool. And that's the way to achieve the lowest rate for the funds.
Going back to your model, this bill neutrality issue, how is that defined? Because, I mean, there's obviously a lot of factors that go into the how the bill will change over time. How do you, does your model, do you define it? And if so, how?
We did not define how we calculated the bill neutrality in there. My vision would be that it would just be a simple, straight up. You wouldn't take into account escalating utility costs. You wouldn't take into account maintenance costs, etc. You would want to do it as simple as possible. So if a customer was going to save $1,000 a month on their utility bill, then you're going to want to see a loan payment that's no greater than $800. And you would actually match, there's some language in here to match the term of the loan so that you're achieving the shortest term possible during that period. Because obviously you decrease the risk of default with the shorter term loan.
Okay, I guess maybe some of my concern has to do with more marketing than, I guess you're talking about whether the loan gets approved. My concern is when you're telling the customer this will be bill neutral, but then, you know, it's a two-year loan, but then 18 months down the road, that, you know, all of a sudden now he's paying $100, $1,000 more than what he was before the loan, taking on the loan, because of change in energy costs, energy prices, you know, distribution charges, all that stuff that can go up over time. So that's all I just wanted.
Right.
How do you respond to that?
And instead of putting in escalation factors, it was the idea of driving for 20% below. So in other words, if it's 1,000, shooting for 800, with the idea the loan would be short-term enough that the bill would not go up by 20%. Because even if we use the current forecasting methods that are in Act 129, for example, with the TRC based on current, the gas and spark and everything going out, we're not going to see a 20% increase. But if something changes in the market and we see a 20% increase, I don't know that we could forecast that at this point.
Just to make sure I haven't lost truth here, that calculation around forecast bill neutrality is for the purpose of deciding on the size of the payment and the terms of the loan. The bill will still reflect the charges of the day. So it's
correct.
You're not suggesting that we bill a flat amount and hope that it works out.
No, okay. No, it would
so,
still.
So tell me a little bit about how that works. We read the meter, we calculate a charge. Do we send you an EDI transaction then that says it's time to send us your loan amount so that we can stick that on the bill as well? Is that?
You could either initiate the EDI transaction, or the administrator could initiate the EDI transaction to the utility saying, hey, it's that time during your next billing cycle.
Yeah,
this is the amount.
It's our bill cycle that kicks everything. So really the bill has to be read. So it needs to go to you and then come back. That amount should be always the same, right?
Correct.
And then we put those two on, remit a bill to the customer. If it's a commercial customer in the PPL territory, they have 20 days to pay. And you said something there may be a one-day difference for mailing or something like that. So you said within, we don't pay you as received, we pay you at each 20-day billing cycle interval, is that?
That's correct.
Well, I said you, and I don't mean you. The administrator, I guess, is the
correct
entity I'm talking about. And if there's a partial payment applied, we need to send you an EDI 568 or something that tells you we applied a partial amount. We got enough to cover our charges and some of yours. So here's yours, and here's a 568 that tells you what you're missing.
The actual communication detail we'd need to work out, yes.
Okay, well, it's not that complicated to describe. It's damn complicated to program. So
correct.
I'm just trying to get a sense. So then you would hold that 568, and then the second month send us the normal monthly amount plus
the past due
the amount that's missing, and then we'd go through that exercise
correct
again.
And it would be a levelized payment throughout the entire period.
Yeah, but you'd always be sending us that amount. We wouldn't have to keep a cheat sheet to know what to put on Joe Blow's.
No.
Okay.
And just can I ask another question about the bill neutrality? So the bill neutrality issue, you use that to determine the payment, but you're not, as Chris I think was getting at, you're not using that necessarily as a heavy marketing tool, right? Because you know, your utility, you get more gadgets, you add another computer, you expand your business.
The in-laws move in.
Well, I mean,
oh, not in a business,
sorry. You know? I'm just thinking that's really not the heavy marketing tool, right? It's more the way you're trying to set your loan amount, you're trying to approve that project based on a projection that it's going to have a certain amount of energy savings, that's going to reduce your bill a certain amount, and that's how you get the project approved. Because there'd be no way over a 3, 4, 5 year period that your bill would necessarily stay.
Correct.
Okay.
It decreases the potential for default.
Okay.
So like when we were talking about multifamily earlier, if that multifamily owner was currently paying a $15,000 bill and he went in and did a retrofit and now he's paying a $14,000 bill every month, if he defaults on that $14,000 bill, he would have defaulted on that $15,000 bill also, without doing the retrofits.
Right, but it's also, I mean, my point also was you have seasonal variations in your bill as well.
Correct.
That
yeah.
that the particular energy savings does not address.
Correct.
Or may not address.
Well, while we're on a tiny little break, if we could take maybe just a 5-minute breather and then come back, if that would be all right. I think we've been having a great discussion. Maybe just a couple minutes break would be nice.
The one thing that I want to be sure
that's the case. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.